Luis Daniel Munoz, welcome to the Publix Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us, why are you running to be the next governor of Rhode Island?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I'm running for a lot of reasons. I mean, growing up in Central Falls, experiencing economic hardship, going through the public school system, and eventually after graduating from Rhode Island College, going on to become a medical doctor at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, it gave me a full, I would say, perspective on how these systems work, and frankly, how they haven't changed much since I was a kid in Central Falls. I think it's time to effect programmatic changes. I think it's also time to bring a level of courage that working families and marginalized communities have had to push back against cronyism and special interests, and to ensure that the federal dollars we have today are actually allocated in ways that build up systems that will serve the next seven generations.
As you say, you grew up in Central Falls. You're 36 years old, I believe. What have you done or accomplished that indicates that you have the skills and experience to effectively lead the state?
Yeah. It's interesting when we talk about what skills it would take to lead a state. I think we should start from a place of courage. And second to that, I can certainly say that I have insights into healthcare systems, healthcare technologies, how to build out operations around contact tracing and vaccination systems, and how to do so in a way that equity is at the forefront. And that is something that I've been very involved with over the past 2 years. But in doing so, I guess what I'm really saying, Ian, is that, you know, having operational skills, being able to scale and deploy technologies and to work with stakeholders at multiple levels is certainly a management skill set, but there's more to leadership than just management. And I believe that political courage and moving in a way that, again, brings equity to the table and that brings light to marginalized communities and to working communities that are struggling every day to live in the state is something that we have not had in the governor's office. And I think it's time for that.
We'll talk more about healthcare policy shortly. But first, you referred to how you went to medical school. You don't practice as a doctor. So how do you support yourself?
Yeah. So consulting and contract work, again, specifically around the intersection of clinical operations and healthcare technology. And most recently, my work has been involved in building out contact tracing, as well as vaccination systems. I am currently a resident of Pawtucket. Most of my industry work has been in the state of Massachusetts. While here, I have been working within the state's Equity Council as a community advocate. Really pushing as much as I can against two administrations now to make sure that their plans and, frankly, again, that we have a lens of equity in front of the plans that they have to ensure that everyone has access to resources.
Well, let's get into some issues. You say that healthcare should be free for everyone in Rhode Island. How much would it cost to achieve that vision, and how would you pay for it?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for the question. It is a heavy question. I think that there's a path to single payer. Let's start from a place of, I believe healthcare is a human right. Second to that, we can look at what language has been used around healthcare for all. And we've heard a lot of Medicare for all, and that certainly has come from our, you know, U.S. senators and on the national front. If the federal government doesn't move on Medicare for all, then as a state, I think we should start thinking about that is how do we move and start to implement a single payer system. And to do so, it's a multi-pronged approach. First, we need infrastructure. Whenever we've heard about free healthcare, oftentimes we hear about just payment systems and ensuring that money is going into the system and that the state is covering it and that there is a tax revenue that is providing the capital necessary to provide free healthcare. My concern is if, as a state, we're paying into an expensive system, a system driven by large hospital systems, then it's going to be unsustainable. So we really need to build out community health infrastructure. We can use federal dollars, a large chunk of the federal dollars, the ARPA funds that we have today, to ensure that we're building out community health infrastructure. As a state, I believe that we should also have a state medical and dental school. We should create a very affordable path for people to become physicians and dentists to supplement that community health system, to make it sustainable. And if we have our foot in the door, Ian, in the delivery system itself, that's where we ultimately can support the control of cost, because it isn't only about pharmaceutical. It is the cost of services as well. And that's what oftentimes is not talked about when we talk about healthcare for all. So community healthcare is a first step to that. Second step is getting to that negotiation table on behalf of all Rhode Islanders and making sure that the cost of care is as low as it can be so that we can sustain it, again, with tax revenues. And we can talk more about that if you have any questions.
Can you put a ballpark dollar figure either on the complete transition to single payer that you support or the more incremental step of a more robust commitment to community health centers and community health?
Yeah, so, you know, clinics have, I don't want to say deteriorated, but have closed down. We often talk about free clinics in the context of Wallace free clinics, so physicians that are doing pro bono work essentially for the community. We see a lot of that, and thank you so much to those physicians that are engaged in that work. But we need to build out legitimate infrastructure around free clinics that are publicly managed. And when I think about the infrastructure is going to be required to create that, we have to think about it in the same context of affordable and low-income housing in this state. So we're looking at a ballpark of $400 to $600 million for affordable and low-income housing, which we should be spending and as quickly as possible. We should also be thinking of that kind of estimate for healthcare infrastructure. And again, the savings that we provide to all families once that system is built is going to be astronomical. And people are going to be able to survive and thrive in this state, whereas now they're just struggling to make rent.
Let's move on to jobs and the economy. What are your top one or two ideas on how to expand work-related opportunities to bring about a more robust economy in Rhode Island?
Yeah, a lot of people talk about bringing jobs, and they talk about you know, what that means, infrastructure, attracting companies. I want to be very clear. We have tried and failed time and time again to work with corporations. And ultimately, when I say fail, they don't bring jobs here. They take tax breaks, and ultimately they leave, they jump ship when they need to consolidate their assets because they're in financial trouble. It's time to really focus on micro businesses. I want to completely transform Commerce, Rhode Island. We're done focusing on corporations. We're going to focus on micro businesses. We're going to focus in many ways. One is we need to support businesses around infrastructure. We know that when the PPP loans came out, they were businesses in South Providence that didn't have QuickBooks. I mean, and just for not having that one instrument, they were unable to pull their finances together in enough time to even apply for a loan. We also need to talk about a supplemental wage program. How do we first acknowledge that minimum wage is a poverty trap when you're talking to a bodega that you are not supporting on a business front through commerce, and then now they're having to almost try to negotiate from a values and economic perspective, how do I pay my workers more when that's going to put me out of business? That's the trap in of itself. So a supplemental wage program supports the minimum wage earner, but through the business itself. And by doing so, fosters probably a better quality service in that business because a person works one job. But also, it is an operational cost that the business can now kind of consider as having support for, and then think more about how do we scale this? How do we get more employees? And then lastly, we also, I think, have an opportunity today to take the infrastructure that the Raymundo administration built out, like across the pedestrian bridge in Providence, and to really connect it to the community. I was surprised that there's not a trolley that goes from the CIC building all the way down to South Prov. That is a way to create access to opportunity. The fact that that trolley or bus is not really there specific for bringing people to that environment, I think it perpetuates, right, the inequity and the inaccessibility that opportunity in Rhode Island has, that people have had when it comes to opportunity in Rhode Island, unfortunately.
You spell out a lot of your ideas on your website. Before my next question, just tell our listeners about your website, what the URL is, so if they want to find out more.
Yeah, thank you. It's LuisDanielMunoz.com, but we've also created a URL, governor2022.com, just as a reminder. And that'll direct you to the website. We do have all of the platform and policy positions are there. When comparing myself to other candidates, I personally think it's very important to take, you know, show where we stand from a values perspective, but also from an implementation side, how we're going to get things done. And if I can just add, Ian, so often political consultants are saying campaigning is one thing, governing is another. But those are two realities and different realities. And if candidates are trying to exist in those two realities, are they going to have a grip on reality when they get into office? I'm presenting my positions. I'm very straightforward and saying what I believe. And hopefully Rhode Islanders will see that that's what it's going to take to affect programmatic change.
To push back a little bit against something you said earlier, you say the state of Rhode Island too often marginalizes low-income people, working people. We know the state budget has climbed over $10 billion a year. The biggest part of that goes for social services and education. lots of money is spent on the social safety net. Doesn't that rebut your criticism that marginalized and low-income people are overlooked?
You know, on the surface, we're saying that we're spending on social service programs, right? But when we dig in, for instance, we look at Medicaid managed care organizations that are siphoning capital just by serving as an intermediary that's very expensive. So in healthcare, we see that these intermediary organizations that have a role in our ability to get money to those that need it for the services they need is actually becoming very costly. We also see that the Raimondo administration and now the McKee administration are privatizing public health. And so is privatization of public health in a public health response where we've seen temporary hospitals built out that are very expensive and unused, is that the path that Rhode Island should take? But from an optics standpoint, we're saying public health. So unless someone is digging in and seeing how it's being privatized, it would seem that we're pouring a lot of money and it's getting to the people. My concern, Ian, is it's not getting to the people. It's not getting to the areas that we need the most. Our U.S. senators in 2020, during a pandemic, only brought $750,000 for community health infrastructure, where we spent double that for temporary hospitals that we never used. So just as an example, I don't think the money is getting to the people. I think when I talk, not I think, when I speak of programmatic change, it is about digging into the line items. It is about ensuring that those dollars are in fact getting to the place where they're either in people's pockets, services of healthcare, education resources for kids, or again, just economic opportunity for minimum wage earners and the working and the marginalized.
I've been covering politics in Rhode Island for more than 20 years, and I've seen some of the biggest changes in the state be driven by grassroots activism. That was the case with the passage of same-sex marriage in 2013, the passage of a state-based abortion law in 2019. If you were to win election as governor, in all likelihood, there would remain a legislature and legislative leaders who would not be about to implement your program. So, could you not be more effective as an activist outside of government trying to create change rather than as an elected official?
Between the last time I ran and now, there's some interesting insights that I learned on the state's equity council. Being an activist and pushing back again against an administration that does not want to move on issues of equity certainly was one strategy. But here's where that strategy falls short, that you can also be on the state equity council for months talking about a problem and nothing happens until the problem takes effect, until people start to realize that they can't get into mobile vaccine clinics because they don't have an ID. And then suddenly, now that there are news stories about it, an administration reacts to it. We've had reactive politics in Rhode Island for too long. And yes, there are legislators that will likely disagree from a values perspective or implementation plan side on some of the vision that I'm presenting. But where I think a governor has an opportunity in Rhode Island that others have not executed on is an opportunity to bring light to areas where there has not been light, to inform the public that there are ways of actually implementing these programs, of reducing the cost of care, the cost burden of care on working families, of supporting our undocumented population, right, and ensuring that they have human rights. Because at the end of the day, we have a community here, even lineages that currently are documented that came, whose grandparents had come to this country and found themselves in similar circumstances. We can all move forward collectively, Ian, but I don't feel like we've had administrations that want to acknowledge the challenges. Because if you acknowledge the problem, you have to solve it.
A related question. You are running what you call a people-powered campaign. You're raising far less money than your five other Democratic rival candidates. What is your pathway to winning this race when you're eschewing many of the conventional rules of politics, like the belief that you have to raise a lot of money to win?
Yeah, we acknowledge the seriousness of raising money. I do want to put that up front. We also know that there will likely be some type of threshold set up that we'll need to meet in order to participate in debates. The mechanics of running a campaign in U.S. electoral politics is very clear, but it is a people-powered campaign. Our every element of our campaign has been powered by creative minds throughout the state of Rhode Island. We have had over 32 activists and organizers that are a part of various organizations that have been conducting mutual aid for years stand with us. We have a documentary coming out in the next few weeks that is going to bring light to their story, their history, and at the intersection of their histories, how we can collectively move together. I've spent time in South County and across other counties as well. I was just on the reservation last week, and it's so interesting that we talk about free public transit in the state of Rhode Island and low income and affordable housing. And yet in the town of Charlestown, there's no bus near the reservation for people to get to work. The low-income housing that was expected to be built for elders was essentially destroyed in an indirect and yet still direct way by the town of Charlestown, which prohibited permits or blocked them from getting permits. And now they have restrictions on ocean access. So when I say people powered, it is not that any one word or phrase or is going to incite someone to move. You know, there have been inequities and struggles and injustices taking place. And it just so happens that in 2021, people are ready to move and to move collectively. And we're gonna make this happen.
Finally, there's some debate among some progressives about whether it makes more sense to support you or Matt Brown, another of the Democratic candidates for governor. What do you say to that question of why those kind of progressive voters should support you rather than Matt Brown?
What I can say about my own work and the actions I've taken is my actions have aligned with my beliefs. And those actions and beliefs align with what's presented on the website, governor2022.com. And, you know, this isn't something where you decide to run, and it shouldn't be. I mean, I guess historically in the US and Rhode Island, it has been, but you shouldn't just decide to run and then throw money at ads and expect to convince someone that you're on a spectrum of left to right. Who is fighting for those who are working and marginalized, those who are living paycheck to paycheck? There have been rent relief resources available in the state, and who has been calling out the administration to deploy them through Rhode Island Housing. Myself and Representative Leonella Felix and Direct Action for Rights and Equality and George Wiley Center and other mutual aid organizations have been trying to keep people in their homes with roofs over their head because housing is a human right. In addition to the mobile vaccine clinics, where just yesterday, the Department of Health presented to the Rhode Island State Equity Council and showed that there was a peak in vaccinations for our racialized communities, Black, Indigenous, Asian, and Latino communities. And that one peak across 6 months were 2 days that we organized, the people, over 100 community activists, organizers, and organizations, organized mass vaccination opportunity for those who wanted to get the vaccine, and over 5,000 people were vaccinated. That's just a testament that community-driven solutions, that doing the work both now before I'm governor and when I'm governor, will actually not only affect programmatic change, but it's going to provide opportunities for this generation, the next seven generations, that we haven't had in Rhode Island ever.
That's all the time we have, so we need to leave it there. Thank you for joining us, Democratic candidate for Governor Luis Daniel Munoz.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. Thank you for having me.
As usual, you can find a lot more on our website at thepublicsradio.org. I'm Ian Donis.